Fotografie neu denken, der Podcast.
Ja, moin zusammen und herzlich willkommen zum dritten Teil meiner Berichterstattung über das internationale La Gacilli Baden Fotofestival in Baden bei Wien, das jedes Jahr von Juni bis Oktober stattfindet und jetzt noch bis zum 13. Oktober zu sehen ist. Umsonst und draußen. Mein Name ist Andy Scholz. Ja, Welt, Natur, Erbe, so lautet der Titel und das Programm des Festivals La Gacilli Baden Foto 2024 in Baden bei Wien und ist ein Appell an die Welt. Denn es ist unsere Pflicht, die Poesie der Schöpfung unseren Kindern zu bewahren. Daher nimmt das Festival zu den grundlegenden Fragen der Urbanisierung, der Artenvielfalt, der natürlichen Ressourcen, der Umweltverschmutzung oder der Klimaerwärmung Stellung und versucht, mit Hilfe von Bildern zumindest Denkanstoße zu geben. So steht es geschrieben auf der Festival-Webseite. Und ich finde, das La Gacilli Festival in der Bretagne und das in Baden bei Wien von Lois und seinem Team werden dem mehr als gerecht. Ja, anfangen möchte ich heute mit keinem Geringeren als Sebastião Salgado und seiner Arbeit Amazonia. Er schreibt dazu selber, nachzulesen auf der Festival-Webseite: Für mich ist Amazonien die letzte Grenze. Ein mysteriöses eigenes Universum, in dem die immense Kraft der Natur wie nirgendwo sonst auf der Erde zu spüren ist. Sehr schönes Zitat. Im Begleittext dazu heißt es: Jahrhundertelang war der Amazonas auch als grüne Hölle bekannt. Ein undurchdringlicher, sumpfiger Dschungel, der Besucher nichts als Gefahr bot. Diejenigen, die ihn überlebten, wurden durch ihre Geschichten berühmt. Doch viele Expeditionen, vor allem jene, die in der mythischen, verlorenen Stadt Eldorado Gold zu finden hofften, kehrten nie zurück. Heute hat der Regenwald den sanfteren, fast romantischen Ruf eines grünen Paradieses und ist vor allem dafür bekannt, dass er ein einzigartiges Naturerbe beherbergt, mit einer der höchsten Konzentrationen von Pflanzenarten auf dem Planeten, darunter 16.000 Baumarten und unzählige Gewächse mit bemerkenswertem medizinischem Potenzial. Darüber hinaus absorbiert diese unvergleichliche Pflanzendichte Treibhausgase und produziert Sauerstoff. Er bietet außerdem seit jeher Hunderten von indigenen Stämmen, von denen einige noch nie Kontakt zur Außenwelt hatten, einen sicheren Hafen. Wer sich in diesem Wald aufhält, insbesondere in den indigenen Gemeinschaften, lernt ihn in einem anderen Licht kennen. Zunächst einmal ist die Vegetation im Unterholz allgegenwärtig. Äste, die sich ineinander verschlingen, dienen als Spielplatz für die 15 Affenarten, die den Wald bevölkern. Die indigenen Stämme, die eine außergewöhnliche Fähigkeit haben, sich im Unterholz zu bewegen, können tagelang wandern und im Wald schlafen, um Verwandte in einem entfernten Dorf zu besuchen. Auf dem Amazonas dienen Boote als Busse, aber um Nebenflüsse zu erkunden, ist es oft notwendig, ein Motorboot zu leihen, das die Stromschnellen befahren kann. Die Reise durch den Regenwald ist ein berauschendes Abenteuer und ein Privileg, aber auch immer eine Herausforderung. Die Ausstellung wurde von Lelia Warnig Salgado entworfen und in Zusammenarbeit mit dem Studio Sebastião Salgado erstellt. Der mittlerweile 80-jährige Salgado selber war leider aber verständlicherweise nicht vor Ort. Um mehr Informationen zur Arbeit von Salgado zu finden, einfach den Namen in die Suchmaschine eingeben. Es gibt nicht viele Situationen, in denen ich das Gefühl hatte oder habe, hier passiert gerade etwas Außergewöhnliches. So ein Momentum aber war das Gespräch zwischen Pia Parolin und Brent Sturton auf dem La Gacilli Baden Fotofestival vor 3 Wochen. Und zwar ging es in dem Gespräch über das Gebiet mit dem Namen Pantanal in Brasilien. Pia Parolin hat schon lange dort gelebt und geforscht als Biologin und Brent Sturton sagt selber über seine fotografische Arbeit mit dem Titel Pantanal, ein bedrohtes Eden, ich zitiere: In diesem Essay wollte ich die unterschiedlichen Elemente untersuchen, die das Ökosystem des Pantanal bilden. Insbesondere die Wechselwirkung mit dem Amazonasbecken, das seinerseits durch Entwaldung und Landwirtschaft bedroht ist. Im Begleittext heißt es weiter auf der Festival-Webseite, das Pantanal-Naturreservat ist mit seinen 200.000 Quadratkilometern umfassenden Flussauen das größte Feuchtgebiet der Erde. Es ist so groß, dass europäische Entdecker, als sie im 17. Jahrhundert erstmals darauf stießen, es für ein Binnenmeer im Märzen Brasiliens hielten. Es ist etwa so groß wie Österreich, die Schweiz, Slowenien und die Slowakei zusammen und erstreckt sich über die Landesgrenzen hinaus bis in die Nachbarländer Paraguay und Bolivien. Das Pantanal ist durch sehr ausgeprägte Regen- und Trockenzeiten gekennzeichnet und verändert sich das ganze Jahr über. Innerhalb eines Monats kann sich ein filigranes Netz gewundener Flüsse, die von üppiger Vegetation umgeben sind, in ein Labyrinth trockener Täler verwandeln, in denen sich seltene Wasserstellen befinden, die eine außergewöhnlich vielfältige Fauna einziehen. Doch dieses tropische Paradies ist gefährdet. Hier sind die Auswirkungen des Klimawandels viel deutlicher zu spüren als anderswo. 2020 führte eine besonders schwere Trockenzeit zu einer Welle verheerender Waldbrände, die fast 30% des Pantanals verwüsteten. 17 Millionen Tiere starben in den Flammen. Zu den Opfern dieser dramatischen Brände gehörten auch die letzten Jaguare des Planeten, deren Bestand vor den Bränden auf etwa 400 Tiere geschätzt wurde. Langsamer und heimtückischer ist der Schaden, den die Bergbauindustrie in der Wasserversorgung der Region anrichtet. Und schließlich gibt es noch Probleme im Hinblick auf das Zusammenleben von Menschen und Wildtieren. Der Fotojournalist Brent Sturton verbrachte mehrere Wochen in Brasilien im Herzen des Pantanal, um sich ein Bild von der Zerbrechlichkeit dieses Naturschutzgebietes zu machen. Brent Sturton, der regelmäßig für National Geographic und das Figaro-Magazin arbeitet und für seine langjährigen investigativen Werke über die Ausbeutung der Natur und der natürlichen Ressourcen bekannt ist, liefert uns einen hoffnungsvollen Fotoessay über diese Oase des Lebens, die wir noch besser kennenlernen müssen, um sie bestmöglich zu schützen. Brent Sturton wurde bereits 15 Mal mit einem World Press Photo Award ausgezeichnet. So oft wie kein anderer Fotograf. Hören wir mal rein in das Gespräch zwischen Pia und Brent auf dem Festival. Pia war übrigens bereits schon mit einer eigenen Episode hier in meinem Podcast zu Gast, und zwar in Episode Nummer 70. Nach wie vor online zu hören. Aber hören wir jetzt mal rein in das Gespräch zwischen Brent und Pia auf dem Lagacili Baden Foto Festival in Baden bei Wien.
Guys, you've been surrounded by work that's taken people several years, okay? Like this show, the one behind with Sebastio, Alan has done great work behind this show. I mean, all work where people have committed to a theme for a long period of time. Now you come to my show, okay? There's a very big difference. And so when you look at this show, maybe the thing to consider is this is what a typical assignment looks like, okay? So I was very lucky. The Rocher Foundation asked me to go to the Pantanal, which is an extraordinarily expensive place to work. And they gave me enough money to do 4 weeks, 2 weeks in the dry season and 2 weeks in the wet season. But it's not several years, and I feel like I did okay. But I, this is not knocking it out the park. This is like doing the best you can in limited circumstances. And if you guys are photographers, then I think you know what that feels like. Okay. So the Pantanal is interesting because it seems to change all the time. Pia, you told me 2 days ago that the Pantanal is on fire again. So come here and tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I've been working in the Pantanal for like 30 years more or less, and so I'm a bit familiar with it. And usually you have a rainy season and a dry season, so the water goes up and down, and this huge area floods, and then it's dry again, and all the animals and plants are adapted also to some fires which may happen with lightning. But in the last years the floods didn't happen anymore as usual. The rainy season didn't happen. It was very bad. 2020, everything burned. Maybe you saw the photos of dead animals around. And so many scientists and NGOs, they made a lot of efforts to replant a lot of trees, and so they did. And then the fires came again. And this year is really, unfortunately, the worst. I was there in April, and that's usually when the dry season starts, but it didn't rain until April. And when I was there, it was supposed to stop the rain and start the dry season, but it was just the opposite. So it hadn't rained, and it started raining in April. So everything is a bit upside down. And yeah, and this year, since it didn't rain very much, it's burning really, really heavily right now, unfortunately.
So this is typical, okay, because as photojournalists, we get to cover a particular period of time. And so the story never finishes unless you really do something in a full cycle. So you doing 5 years on the Amazon project, David doing this job since 2009 and coming back and back with Jennifer. That's what it really takes to do these stories. But funding is an issue, and ADHD is an issue too, because the world is an interesting place and many things require good photography. This is a picture of an area that's permanently flooded in the Pantanal, okay? It's an area where in the very early 1970s, the Brazilian government came up with this idea where they would make super farms in the highlands over the Pantanal. And what ended up happening is that they had record floods that year, and all that topsoil washed down into the Pantanal and changed the course of a number of rivers. And so certain areas became permanently flooded. And that's what it looks like, you know, this is permanently the situation. But in this place, before those floods, before all that soil came down, there were well over 200 cattle farms in the region. So, you know, just again, in terms of like, you know, the macroeconomics of big agriculture, etc., it's a permanent issue in Brazil. Yeah. So, you know, I went to the Pantanal because there had been these really big fires. And when I got there, there was no fire, and the nature had been left alone and really recovered so amazingly that one of the very few evidences of fire that I actually saw was these burnt out trees. And there weren't that many of them because many had already collapsed and were becoming fertilizer. And then one day this very gracious young female jaguar came out and stood in the right place. And for me, it was kind of a metaphoric picture, you know. So most people go to the Pantanal to photograph jaguars diving onto caimans. There are 25,000 really good pictures of that. And I didn't think I had anything to contribute. So I was looking for these kinds of scenes. So this picture is probably a good example of that, what I said to you earlier in terms of how agricultural planning went wrong in the 70s. This was the one of four cattle ranches, you know. So what you find with these farms is they typically only have very old people who really have very few alternatives, and they live in this state of permanent flood. And so what you find as a result of this water is that so many of these pantaneros, you know, the cowboys of the Pantanal, I mean, it's not exactly open plain work most of the time. And so you see over here how they're forced to move their cattle all the time. So this is a common sight in the Pantanal. What I'd like to know is how does it work now? Because when I was there, Bolsonaro, I mean, the soldiers, the Brazilian army arrived 3 months later. The fires were gone, and these guys had been forced to make their own plans, et cetera, et cetera. Is anything changed? I mean, what do you know about the support on the ground?
Well, I mean, there are Brazilians here. Maybe they should explain the situation better than me. But as far as I understand, the consequences of Bolsonaro's regime are continuing, and so far that it's just very hard to control. And so they took the chance to burn as much land as they could when they were allowed to. And it's very hard to reestablish all the control systems, because one of the first things that Bolsonaro took down was the INPE, which was the aerial control where they looked for fires and for cutting areas and everything. So it's a slow locomotive that takes on again. And then there are also the local politicians, the governors of the state of Mato Grosso, Mato Grosso do Sul, and several others who prohibited fishing. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, starting on the 1st of January of this year. So the people are not allowed to fish or they can fish and they have to eat the fish right there where they are, but they're not allowed to take it like a kilometer further down. Which, I mean, there are lots of interpretations for this, but it's probably due to the idea that they kind of want to break the idea that the Pantanal is a wetland and it should turn into agricultural land, dry land, where you can grow more soybean, more sugarcane, and then turn the rivers into something a bit like we have in Europe, where you can navigate the whole year long, so that the rivers are not, as you said, in this very dynamic system which change every other year, and you have a city and you have the river, and the next year the river is 1 kilometer further on the other side. So they want to change this so that they have more production of agricultural produce and can transport it all the way down, because it's all linked with the Rio Paraguay down to the Rio La Plata system and off to the ocean. So that's the plan for people who want to make money. And I think it's not so smart, just because we need water. Yes, I mean, dredging a system that is based on sediment is kind of difficult, because the more you dredge, the more sediment is coming from the sides, and it will never stop. And the problem is the water cycles. I mean, all the big cities are in the southeast in a way, and they are not directly related to the Pantanal, but in a way, I mean, you have seen maybe the flying rivers, so it's all linked. And if you dry up a wetland that has the size of Switzerland, it will definitely affect the water supply to São Paulo, to Rio, and so on.
Pierre, let me just talk to you about this a little bit this year, because you know what was interesting here was this was fairly close to the Pantanal site. This was new ownership of farmlands. You know, guys from Sao Paulo, et cetera, et cetera. And for the first time, they were baling hay. And what it meant was that they weren't going to move their cattle. I thought that was interesting, you know. What's your thoughts on that? Why, is that a negative or a positive in your mind? It's a challenge, right?
To your mind, I'm a wetland ecologist. So I like the wetlands, I like water. And I like the water to be where it's supposed to be. And that's not here. So, well, I mean, the Pantanal has always been a place where people lived. It's a bit like a Kulturlandschaft, how do you say this? Culturally shaped landscape, where people have lived for a long time shaping the environment, cutting down trees, having cattle, having other animals. So it's an interaction, and in the way the people who lived there, as you explained, they adapted. And I had an interesting thing that I observed one day. The horses in the Pantanal, they are able to feed on the grass below water. So they literally dive their nostrils below the water and feed on the grass, which is quite crazy. But you see the same thing in the Camargue, in the delta of the Rhône River. You have the same. You have horses who feed on this. So just a little observation of a biologist. But I love that. But it's supposed to be a wetland. And the natural cycles are already more difficult because of the climatic changes, but people influence a lot the water incidents, because the headwater forest, the forests where the headwaters are being cut to make beautiful residences for the people who want to live outside the heat of the Pantanal. So on the weekend, we drive up and are in this wonderful, cooler, fresher environment in these beautiful modern houses, but it's not really sustainable in the way that there used to be forest where the water would come from. So we are cutting down a little bit everywhere. I'm stopping. But thank you to give visibility to this.
Ja, das Gespräch zwischen Brent und Pia, könnt ihr euch vorstellen, hat natürlich noch ein bisschen länger gedauert. Ich musste jetzt aber hier ein bisschen die Entscheidung treffen, damit es nicht zu lange wird. Die mehr zur Arbeit von Pia noch, die gibt es natürlich auch. Pia fotografiert auch selber, lebt unter anderem in Nizza in Südfrankreich und ist, wie sie schon sagte, mehr als 30 Jahre lang immer wieder in Brasilien in dem Pantanalgebiet gewesen. Mehr zu ihrer Arbeit unter www.piaparolin.com. Ja, und zu Brent Sturton gibt es natürlich auch eine Webseite, die heißt www.brentsturton.com. Und selbstverständlich sind wie gewohnt die ganzen Informationen in den sogenannten Shownotes zum Anklicken für euch und für Sie aufbereitet. Ja, weil wir gerade schon auch so ein bisschen beim Thema Wasser waren, kommen wir damit zu einem weiteren Thema, das nicht weniger aktuell sein könnte, nämlich die Überfischung. Ich zitiere: Man muss einiges aushalten können. Die Fischer harren tagelang zu viert in einer alten Blechbüchse auf einem unberechenbaren Meer aus. Bei diesem leidenschaftlichen Beruf darf man sich nicht vor langen Arbeitszeiten fürchten, schreibt Lorraine Tursi selber über ihre Arbeit Ein Leben im Schleppnetz. Im Festival-Begleittext heißt es: Auf der einen Seite das Meer, das sich unendlich weit am Horizont erstreckt. Die frische Luft und das außergewöhnliche Gefühl der Gleichzeitigkeit von Unsterblichkeit und extremer Verletzlichkeit, wenn die schaumbedeckten Wellen das Boot wie ein Blatt im Wind hin und her werfen. Auf der anderen Seite sind da der Schlafmangel, die Orientierungslosigkeit, das höllische Arbeitstempo, der Alltag in einer feindlichen, unberechenbaren Umgebung. Ganz zu schweigen davon, dass die Seekrankheit auch die Jüngsten befällt, für die das anstrengende Ungleichgewicht zwischen Innenohr und Sichtfeld eine weitere Herausforderung darstellt. Die dunkle Seite eines Berufs, der die Arbeit der Hochseefischer seit vielen Jahren zu den gefährlichsten Berufen der Welt macht, bedeutet auch, dass es immer schwieriger wird, junge Menschen als Mitarbeiter zu gewinnen, obwohl er für viele gleichbedeutend mit Abenteuer ist. Um das Leben auf einem Trawler zu dokumentieren, hat sich Lorraine Tursi an Bord zweier Schiffe begeben, indem sie viel Zeit Seite an Seite mit diesen Seeleuten verbrachte. Bis sie fast Teil der Besatzung wurde, hat sie Bilder geschaffen, die so nah an ihrem Motiv sind, dass man die Gisch des Meeres, die Dieselabgase, das rostende Metall, den frischen Fisch und den Zigarettenrauch fast riechen kann. In diesem Sinne zeigt Lorraine Tursi die Arbeit von Überlebenden. Arbeit, die auf Fachwissen und Überlieferung beruht. Es ist die ebenso einfache wie erstaunliche Geschichte von Menschen, die auf dem Meer leben. Hören wir mal rein, was sie selbst gesagt hat.
For me, it was important to meet really the life of this man, and I managed to discuss with them anyway. And this work is about transmitting what is really their life. On the side of the exotism of the images, there is a reality of people working, and is this man? It's their artwork that are feeding us, and they are very proud of it. And it's an in-between word because, in the same time, they are working on trawlers. Trawlers is the worst way of fishing because it takes everywhere from the ground and the sea, and nothing is left. But, so the thing is, these men are working on small scale, only 4 people, as we said, on board, very small ships. In 1 year, they can fish what the industrial one harvest in one night. 1 year, 1 night. It's very different. The scale is very different. And these men are dedicating all their life to feeding the people. And their life, the day, night, because I couldn't believe that in 2024, where people in Europe have still this kind of way of life. Because if this condition would be ashore, it's forbidden. Because each 4 hours, they have to wake up if they are sleeping or eating on anything. It's for taking the trawler out of the water for fish and to sort the fish, to repair the nests. It's hard work every day. And each time, they can sleep for maybe 2 hours in a row, maximum. And they're doing this for 10 days. Go back at ashore 2 days and go back at sea. It's a crazy life, definitely. And some people said to me, but you were seasick and it was hard time. But I was on board for 4 days. They are doing this for life, daily life. And so trawler, it's not about this man. And because some of them told to me, you know, my daughter, she was appointed at school because your father is a dolphin killer. And it's very harsh for her because His father is proud of his job, of course, and that's normal. And because it's not this man who was doing the best, it's about the system. It's about political decision. I mean, the fishermen, they are okay for the quotas, for example, because they want that fish is still there. So it's for them, it's very important to just be doing their job and sorry for my English. And I have many stories because as photographer, I think that we are just messengers from these people to you directly. And I that's why I write a lot what they speak directly. I don't try to translate. I just give you the sentence that they gave it to me. And, you know, I have a visitor that told me the last time, you know, now that when I will see the fish that I'm eating in my plate, I will think to these guys.
Ja, mehr Informationen zu Lorraine Tursi unter www.lorrainetursi.com. Ja, schließen möchte ich den dritten und letzten Teil meiner Berichterstattung über das Lagersili Baden Fotofestival mit jemandem, den vielleicht schon einige von euch und Ihnen, die jetzt hier zuhören, bereits kennen. Denn er hat 1990 den Pulitzerpreis gewonnen. Die Rede ist von David Turnley und seine Arbeit in den Tiefen der Seele. Er selbst schreibt, ich zitiere von der Festival-Webseite, seit meinen Anfängen habe ich gelernt, wie wesentlich es ist, das Vertrauen der Fotografierten zu gewinnen, um vollständig in ihre Existenz einzutauchen und so echte, intime Augenblicke festzuhalten. Hören wir mal rein, was er sehr beeindruckend selbst erzählt.
Two nights ago, I'm sitting in my apartment in Paris, where I live with my wife, who's here, where are you? Rachel, and my daughter, Dawson. Dawson, come here for a sec, please. Because she's really the star of the show. So two nights ago, I'm talking to her about what should I say to this audience in La Gacelie. And she disappears into her bedroom and she comes back with an iPad. And she has written, hello, my name is David Turnley. I photographed Nelson Mandela. That's all you have to know. But she's kind of right, actually. And I was thinking as we're walking along that I could sort of try to do these kinds of talks, which have been brilliant, by the way, to connect with the photographs. But it's really a little difficult. So I'm going to tell you a good story. Is that okay? And the story won't go long. But it's a story that involves also my twin brother, which, and I think the story may tell you a lot about who I am and who we are, and hopefully maybe why I do what I do and a little bit my motivation. So, in 1985, I was working at a newspaper in Detroit, and at that time, Detroit was incredibly segregated. There had been race riots in 1967, and the city had gone from being 50% white, 50% black, to about 90% black, 10% white. And it also coincided with the suburbanization of America, so there was this white flight that was happening. And Detroit was really the iconic city in America that was revealing the division in America. And I was very sensitive growing up in a family that was very involved in the civil rights movement. Dr. King had been my hero. And I was photographing the realities for people of color in Detroit, which had not been done previously. And it occurred to me one day in 1985, as I was following very closely what was going on in South Africa, that actually I should go to South Africa because I believed in joining the struggle against apartheid. But I also thought that if I could make photographs in South Africa that revealed the indignations and humiliations of prejudice, that people in Detroit could see this and they might learn something about the notion of dignity, of humiliation, of dismissal of people. And the newspaper sent me. It was meant to be about a six-week assignment. As I arrived in South Africa, the country was exploding, and every day, for what was meant to be a six-week assignment, I was up and down the country in the middle of riots in townships all over the country. And in fact, what was meant to be a six-week assignment turned to be many years of my life. And I was one of the last international photographers to have received a visa from the South African government, and my photographs were being distributed by Black Star all over the world to magazines around the world, and it was an incredible privilege to wake up every day and contribute to the struggle. In late 1987, it was an honor that I'm about to offer to you that won't seem like an honor. I was actually kicked out of South Africa by the white regime because my work was having too much effect around the world. And it was a kind of compliment in those days. There were 11 journalists that year that were kicked out of South Africa. I went to Paris, where I was based, to cover the world. And I couldn't go back to South Africa for the first 2 years. I was persona non grata. And in 1990 in Paris, I receive a phone call. Mr. Turnley, this is the ambassador from the embassy in South Africa. I'd like to have lunch with you. And I was quite confused and, to be honest, a little bit suspicious. And I said, sure, we can have lunch. And I go to this very fancy five-star restaurant in Paris and meet this very large ambassador from the South African embassy who sits in front of me and says, Mr. Turnley, things are about to change in our country and we want people with your credibility to go back and cover those changes. And I frankly really was suspicious. In those years, the white regime would do anything to destroy the integrity of journalists or photojournalists whose power, whose work was having an effect. And I said to him, I will accept your visa under two conditions. Number one, that the visa has no conditions. And number two, that I pay for lunch. And the man looked at me and said, I have no idea why you want to pay for lunch, but of course. And I took a flight that night to Johannesburg. And I arrived in Johannesburg to find out the next day that Nelson Mandela was being released on November 11th in 1990, just several days later. And that's why I was being asked to return to South Africa. And this had been a dream of mine, as it had been for millions of people around the world. And my twin brother was at that time working as the photographer based in Paris for 25 years for Newsweek, and he had arrived in South Africa. And on the night before, we called Nelson Mandela Madiba. That's his tribal name, and those of us who knew him well, that was how we called him affectionately. And Madiba was meant to be released the next day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I got a very good night's sleep that night because I knew I was going to be up very early and work very late, and I wanted to be sharp, and I knew it was going to be an incredible day. And around midnight, I receive a phone call, and it's a colleague of mine from a South African photojournalist. He said, David, you know I love you, but the South African Photographers Union decided today that tomorrow's event is going to be a pool event, and there will only be 5 photographers allowed in front of the prison. And I said to my friend John, John, you know that I love you and I respect you, but if you think for one second that I will not be in front of that prison tomorrow morning, you're crazy. And I called my brother and I said, Peter, we have a problem. We have to get out in front of that prison very early tomorrow. And we agreed, and we arrived in front of the prison. It was the prison that Mandela was held in before he was released was a medium security prison outside of Paarl, which is about 45 minutes from Cape Town. And we arrived in front of the prison, and there were 2 Afrikaner prison guards who were the people that guarded prisons in those years. And we went to these 2 guards and we said, you know what's about, we shook their hands and we very, with much dignity, because I always believe in that, as does my brother, I said, you have 2 choices today. You can become part of something that's going to be historically important to the entire world, or you can allow only 5 photographers to be in front of this prison on what is probably one of the most important days in the history of the world. And what we need you to do is to give us a rope, and we promise you we will create a pen for the photojournalist that is about 30 feet wide, and we will self-police ourselves so that we don't, as the argument had been that there will be decorum on this particular day, we will make sure that we behave, but the world needs to see this moment. And they agreed, and they got us a rope. And we set up our 30-foot pen, and from about 4 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, photojournalists from all over the world arrived, and before the afternoon at 4 o'clock, when there were helicopters overhead and every television station in the world was waiting to watch Madiba walk out of prison, there were probably 250 photographers standing behind me, and I hadn't moved for probably what was 12 hours to protect my space that was about this big. And I knew that the moment that Madiba would walk out with Winnie, that I would probably have, before the crowd broke, about three frames to make. And this was before autofocus cameras and auto exposure cameras. And I was working with a 300-meter lens. And Winnie showed up late, as she tended to do. And Madiba walked out of prison at 4:15. And as he walked out of prison, I made three frames. And the crowd broke just as I expected. And fortunately, my three frames were in focus. And it's one of the most important photographs that I've ever made. They got in their car. There was a motorcade into Cape Town. The motorcade lasted for about 45 minutes, and I got in a car and raced behind them. And when we got to the city hall in Cape Town, there were probably more than 150,000 South Africans who had spent their entire lives waiting for Madiba to walk out of prison and to address South Africa. And when Madiba and the motorcade arrived, Nelson Mandela had not seen a crowd in 27 years. And he apparently really kind of, he asked the driver to please quickly drive him out of the city. In the meantime, I had entered the crowd, and the crowd was dangerous. It was one of those crowds I've been in crowds all over the world, and crowds, as we know, can be dangerous. This was a dangerous crowd, not because they were dangerous, but they were so excited. And I literally had to climb on the shoulders of people just to basically survive, and I effectively walked on the shoulders of the crowd to get on the balcony in front of Cape Town. Now I'm suddenly in a position where if Madiba does arrive, I'm effectively in many respects out of position. So I walk into the city hall and I sort of panically race down a hallway and I open the first door thinking that maybe I can find a window to lean out of. Well, it so happens when I open the door, standing in front of me is the reception committee that involved Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the leaders of the anti-apartheid movement, including the family of Nelson Mandela. And they all knew me, and they said, "David, come in, but please be quiet. Just go to the back." And there were probably about 15 of us. And the world had no idea. The people outside had no idea. And suddenly there's a phone call. And Archbishop Tutu takes the phone. And we hear him say, "Papa, you have to come. Just show your face or they'll tear the city down. You just have to at least show up." And suddenly there's silence, and he puts the phone down and he says, "He's coming." And 5 minutes later, the door opens and in walks Nelson Mandela. And I made the first photographs of Madiba. And as he walked in, everyone, the crowd didn't know he was in the room. The family was all there. Everyone's crying. And at one point, Archbishop Tutu takes a glass and he takes a fork and he sort of knocks the glass to get some silence, and he looks at Nelson Mandela, who's, I'm going to make my daughter Nelson Mandela, and he looks at Nelson Mandela and he says, Baba, you have no idea what your life has meant to my life." And he started to cry, and everyone started to cry. And he stood there so dignified, and afterwards, and everyone else sort of said their piece, and then he said, "Please, you have to forgive me. I have to take care of something." And he stepped out of a window onto a balcony and spoke to the world for the first time in 27 years.
Das ist schon so lange her, und trotzdem hatte David Turnley wirklich Tränen in den Augen, und es muss auch ein wirklich bewegender Augenblick gewesen sein. Ja, mehr zur Arbeit von David Turnley findet ihr unter www.davidturnley.com. Und selbstverständlich, ich wiederhole es immer wieder gerne, selbstverständlich sind all die Informationen in den sogenannten Shownotes direkt zum Anklicken aufbereitet. Ja, das war der dritte und letzte Teil meiner Berichterstattung über das internationale Lager Sidi Baden Fotofestival in Baden bei Wien, das noch bis zum 13. Oktober stattfindet und jedes Jahr von Juni bis Oktober in Baden bei Wien ausgerichtet wird. Und ich hoffe, ich darf nächstes Jahr und kann nächstes Jahr wieder dabei sein. Und hier noch ein kleiner Hinweis: in der Fotopodcast-Folge von den Kollegen von fotopodcast.de, die ich auch in Lager Sidi in Baden getroffen habe, in der Folge vom 8. September 2024 bin ich zu Gast im sogenannten Fotopodcast, den es tatsächlich schon seit 16 Jahren gibt und der zweite Podcast überhaupt zum Thema Fotografie in Deutschland war. Ulrike und Thomas von fotopodcast.de hatte ich bereits letztes und vorletztes Jahr auf dem Lager Sidi Baden Fotofestival von Lois Lammerhuber kennengelernt und dieses Jahr auch den dritten im Bunde, nämlich den Michael Wertmüller aus Fulda. Viele Grüße, wenn ihr das hört, an euch und schaut nochmal in eure E-Mails. Ich habe euch eine Mail geschickt. Und an alle meine Hörer der Aufruf, wenn ihr mich als Interviewpartner mal erleben wollt, dann da auf jeden Fall mal reinhören. Link ist in den Shownotes. Ja, lasst ein kostenloses Abo da, tragt euch in den Newsletter ein und schreibt mir, wenn ihr wollt, eine Mail unter podcast@fotografie-neudenken.de oder besucht uns auf der Frankfurter Buchmesse vom 16. bis zum 20. Oktober 2024. Frankfurter Buchmesse, 16. bis 20.10. Ja, da bleibt nur noch zu sagen, bis zum nächsten Mal, alles Gute da draußen, gesund bleiben und ciao, ciao.
Fotografie neu denken, der Podcast.